Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Four Arrows and Darsha Narvaez. Four Arrows is former Dean of Education at Oglala Lakota College and currently a professor with Fielding Graduate University. Selected by AERO as one of the 27 visionaries in education, he's the author of Teaching Truly, a curriculum to indigenize mainstream education, selected by the Chicago Wisdom Project of one of the top 20 progressive education books. He's currently working on a UNESCO counter-hegemonic democracy book project. And Darsha Narvaez is professor of psychology at the University of Notre Dame, who focuses on moral development and flourishing from an interdisciplinary perspective, integrating anthropology, neuroscience, clinical development, and educational sciences. Her current research explores how early life experience influences moral character in children and adults. She's a fellow of the American Psychological Association and the American Educational Research Association and is former editor of the Journal of Moral Education. She's published more than 20 books, including Indigenous Sustainable Wisdom, First Nation Know-How for Global Flourishing, Basic Needs, Well-Being, and Morality, Fulfilling Human Potential and Embodied Morality, Protectionism, Engagement, and Imagination. Her recent book, Neurobiology and the Development of Human Morality, Evolution, Culture, and Wisdom, won the 2015 William James Book Award from the American Psychological Association and the 2017 Expanded Reason Award. She writes a blog for Psychology Today called Moral Landscapes and hosts a webpage, evolvednest.org. So first, thank you for both of you for your work in the world, and thank you also for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
So the current book that you both have is a result of a conference, and we can either ask what was the conference about, or I can go with a quote from the book. Which would you prefer?
The quote.
Okay, the quote is, this quote gets to the heart of everything, I think. What accounts for the differences between dominant global modern culture and the cultures of successful, sustainable indigenous communities that existed for tens of thousands of years and are still represented today in First Nations who struggle against the odds around the world?
Well, I'm writing a book about that called The Nest, or The Evolved Nest, and exploring that issue. So maybe I'll start. And my work focuses in on what happened to humanity that we became so destructive, at least some humans. So in the civilized world, the industrialized civilized world, what we've been doing is undermining child development. And it's so critical in those first years to establish a good neurobiology, one that's cooperative, that's self-regulated, and that can expand, have a higher consciousness. But what we do in the industrialized world is we undermine all those systems that are supposed to be developing. Children are resilient. They stay alive, you know, just like a dandelion in the crack in the street. That's life wants to live. And so children live, but they're not really all that human. They don't have their human potential reached, and they're undermined, and they get very self-protective and a big ego and fearful, and they're easily controlled by authoritarians. And we see a lot of these effects now. So our nest, we have a nest just like all animals do, and we forgot them in the industrialized world, and we rationalize it away and just blame children for their neediness and blame adults for being evil or out of control. And so for the last few hundred years, we've really made a mess of things. In the indigenous world, the small band hunter-gatherers, especially, we can see the nest provided, the evolved nest, what our species needs to develop well. And in those cultures, you can see cooperative, self-controlled, communal kinds of personalities who know how to live in their landscape. And we've lost that, and we, of course, now have made a global crisis out of all this.
And do you want to say
anything? I'll jump in. I really support what Darsha is focusing on with the early childhood and the nest. I think we know that children are in a state of hypnosis for the first 3 or 5 years, and that's the time for the kind of nurturing and love that she's talking about that is no longer part of the dominant systems. And yet there is a preliminary requirement before this kind of appropriate nurturing of the child can happen. And in my work, I call that worldview transformation. I have a very different approach to worldview, whereas most scholars see worldview, although Darsha and I are, I think, in concurrence on this. We've written about it together. But most scholars see worldviews as beliefs or religions or cultures or ideologies or philosophies, in which case there's conceivably 7 billion worldviews, which makes it a kind of a meaningless concept. And although I don't like the word, it's a European word, and it connotes only vision as opposed to what I think indigeneity is more holistically about, it's the best one we have. And there is a scholar who is the father of social anthropology, Robert Redfield from University of Chicago, who agreed that there's only two worldviews. There were three. There was the Eastern one, the Western one, and what he called the primitive one, we're referring to as indigenous. But later in his in the 50s, in his later years, he said that the Eastern had been assumed. So if there's only two worldviews, there's the dominant one with its characteristics of anthropocentrism and materialism, authoritarianism, etc., and the indigenous one, then, and if the indigenous one is how we were guided for 99% of human history, as Darsha has written, with arguable consequences to the environment. I say arguable because some of the popular scholars like Steven Pinker, you know, their scholarship has been proven poor, but they make a bestseller by saying that it's a good thing we've escaped from the violence of the primitive world. Most scholarship shows that the majority of pre-contact cultures were what we call peaceful societies. They were still humans and still had their same potential for vices, but they established codes of conduct under a different worldview of interconnectedness. So I think the answer that this book talks about is how this worldview is manifested and how we can reclaim it.
So the thank you both for that. There's a couple directions we can go. One is with what you just said, Four Arrows, is can you talk about some of the different ways those worldviews manifest? Or we can go with Darsha. Can you talk more concretely or more tangibly about some of those, what that nest involves? Maybe let's go with that first. What does the nest involve that makes, I'm thinking a couple things. One is can you give tangible examples of the difference that leads the children to be more secure? And then also I keep thinking as I look around this culture of that great line by R.D. Lang about how do you plug a void plugging a void, which is what so many of us in the West end up doing, is trying desperately to fill a void with shopping, which is another void, or fill a void with, you know, expansionism, with bombing the moon, with probing the deepest depths of the ocean, with violating everything. So take any of that, any direction you want.
Okay. Well, our nest is very similar to the social mammal nest, and social mammals emerged about 20 to 40 million years ago. So these characteristics are by and large that old, and that they stayed the same over those millions of years means that they worked to keep our ancestors alive, surviving, thriving, reproducing, and they maintained, they are part of a sustainable way of being. And these characteristics then include things such as breastfeeding on request for several years, responsiveness, keeping babies in optimal arousal state so their biochemistry is in the right form for growing all the different brain systems that develop after birth. We're actually born 18 months early compared to other animals. That is, we look like fetuses till 18 months or so. And so lots of things are scheduled to develop after birth, and that we need an external womb experience during that time. So that's lots of caring and holding and pretty much constant physical contact with caregivers, multiple adult caregivers who are responsive. So it's not just a mom's thing or a mom and dad thing. It's a community care that's provided, a positive environment of social support so that mom feels supported and baby feels welcome. And play, lots of play. Babies are ready to play back and forth, reciprocal exchanges from birth. And what we do instead in the United States is probably the worst in the world, the worst place in the world to grow a child or raise a child, because there's no parental leave so that you can actually breastfeed for very long or be bonded for very long and learn the signals of your particular child. And what we do instead is we sleep train babies to learn to sleep alone. And that undermines their development, just that. We leave them to cry alone, to cry it out, sleep training. That's my most popular blog post, over 2.8 million hits on that, dangers of crying it out, because it is so dangerous for that child that shifts their trajectory of development away from feeling connected and bonded and secure in the world. This is a safe place. I'm a good creature. To the worldview that is, it's dangerous out there. You can't trust anybody. You know, I panic and the fight flight, systems get, hyper reactive. And so for the rest of your life, you don't think very well. If you feel threatened, that you shift, your blood flow shifts to run away. Or if you're left to cry extensively, you have to shut down. You have to actually close down your crying in order to stay alive. And so some kids are left alone to cry and cry until they start to vomit and they have to shut up to stay alive. And then they go into these dissociated states, which we can see hypnotically gone emotionally. And then those people are just, they're not really developed. They don't know themselves. They don't know their spirit, their inner self or uniqueness that they have to bring to the world has gone off the rails. So, and it's just a narrow, I guess, the hole that Artie Lang talks about, the void. You never, ever fill it up because there are sensitive periods for certain things to grow. And it's really hard to fix later unless you do like 8 hours of meditation a day or something. So that's the nest. And we have undermined it and we are paying the price now.
And I'm thinking about something that, you know, you were talking about all this attention to children, which is very important. And I was thinking about the functional impossibility of that if you have a single mother with three children and two jobs and no community. And I'm thinking especially about the role of community. And last year, my mom died, and I was her sole caretaker through the cancer. And it was
hard.
It was impossible. And I'm going to write a book at some point about, you know, they talk about it taking a village to raise a child. And also it takes a village to take care of an elder, because had at the very, very end, I was able to bring in some more people. And at that point I was free to simply love my mom to her death. And up until then, you know, I wasn't getting any sleep. I was just, it was impossible. So can you talk about, and at some point I would like to extend this to the natural world too, but can you both talk about the importance of that functional, larger communal unit in everything?
Well, I think this is the beauty of the connection that you made with what Darsha says, because we're talking now about babies and we're talking now about old people, right? So we've made this full circle. And the question that you just asked, I believe, is probably one of the most fundamental aspects of the two worldviews. And I'm always in this paradox, because in the indigenous worldview, binaries really are minimal or don't exist. A complementarity of all apparent opposites is important. So I just want to preface that. But when you're asking about how do we get this communal perspective for children in the nest and for older people in their last days on this plane, it's the foundational idea of interconnectedness is missing, in my opinion. This foundational worldview of interconnectedness is not it's not just human connectedness. As our friend and one of the presenters in our book, or at least our conference, David Abrams says, not other than human, but greater than human. Until we can truly see the sentience in a cockroach or a cedar tree or a salmon. I just say that because I'm here in the Pacific Northwest and surrounded by salmon and cedar trees. But until we can truly have this sense of respect for all of other life and see this variety of sentience, then how can we be expected to have such respect to develop communities of trust, of communities of caring, communities of engagement with things that are problems like global climate change. Right now we have a young lady who has what is called a disorder with Asperger, right? Because it allows her to concentrate with this kind of deep thinking. And yet, this is something that should be part of all of our ways of being, and we can relearn it. And one of the ways to relearn it is with ceremony, which is really a trance-based learning phenomenon. I just close with a sentence that I often say is, how can you explain the treatment of babies and of older people and of our parents? How can you explain the pollution of Earth in any kind of way other than people are acting as though they're hypnotized?
You know, this help me with this. I've been postmodernism, I think, is really terrible, and it has become an identity politics that becomes sort of a religion in some sense. And it's made me think, and it's really made me think that, that when Western society pretended to get rid of religion with the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment, it left a void, another void. And I think, and it has been filled by some, here's what I'm trying to get at, is I think we have an inherent need for religion and an inherent need for that entrancement, but what we have are toxic mimics of those. And can either of you take that anywhere?
Yeah. So, but the religion that was rejected by the Enlightenment was really a false religion.
But I disagree.
Yeah. So, but I've been reading Richard Rohr, R-O-H-R, he's a Franciscan monk, and really points to the origins of, for example, what Jesus was conveying was that we are all in divinity now, but it's our false selves that have covered that. Our egos are preventing us from tuning in to that sense of connection with everything, with all that the physicists tell us we have. From quantum theory, the DNA analyses show us we're all connected. The indigenous worldview is we're all connected. They had a sense of this without the Western science telling them anything. And that's what, in this Franciscan view, is what the true self is about, to get back to that centered self that feels connected. And unfortunately, the religious structures that all around us don't push us in that direction. They don't focus on self-transformation. They just focus on a meaning, a world of meaning that makes people more anthropocentric and self-centered and ethnocentric instead. So they're missing that second aspect of religion, which is transformation, self-transformation to the true self and the true connections. And indigenous worldview and indigenous wisdom is about that. And the ceremonies that we can pick up help us in that direction. But again, if we have been under cared for in early life, it's so hard to get back. But we can. I mean, we are holistic beings, and we have to find a way to restore our nature, our real nature, which is not all this in-group, out-group, us against them kind of way of being.
Yeah, and I would just modify the semantics a little bit. at this point in time, transformation is crucial. And the recent large study of the Intergovernmental Panel on Extinction Rates has said worldview is the way for that transformation, and refer to indigenous worldview. But I think that in the indigenous worldview, it might be more accurate to say that at birth, you already have it all. We already bring from the spirit world the essence of the interconnectedness.
Yes.
And that the challenge is to not let that be lost by all the things that Darshan writes about, right? And so I think just semantically, it's not the goal of they're born to then learn to transform. It's almost that they're born to fulfill their unique high potential destiny for wherever that is. So it's a subtle difference, but I just thought I'd share that.
No, thank you. I agree with that. It's the child raising of the industrialized, westernized world that pushes children away from their true path, essentially, their true self path. And then they develop all these false paths or false selves or big ego in order to protect themselves. They have to. And so, it's getting back to what you're born with and the pathway that you actually could be developing if you're well cared for early.
So we can presume that everybody listening to this, or most of the people listening to this, were raised in some form of Western society and are and were not raised in that sort of larger extended community with the sort of child rearing you're talking about. So say somebody is 35 or 45 and has been able to break the spell of the dominant culture enough to know that something's wrong. It's like, what do you do as an adult? What do you do as a good-hearted adult to try to repair that in society and in yourself?
I write about this in my blog.
Go ahead.
Okay.
No, you go.
Healing the primal wound, how to self-actualize. These are things that require attention and getting back in tune with your unique self and paying attention to it. What I do with my students, though, in class is they all pretty much are anxious and or depressed. And so we learn self-calming techniques first, because that's the older part of the brain takes over your stress response, for example, and you can't think very well or be very open-hearted or open-minded. So you have to learn to calm yourself down so you can actually grow that openness. And so we do belly breathing and other kinds of visualization and nature connection exercises and things like that. So that's the first thing, is calm down. Figure out when you're getting uncalm, and then learn techniques to shift your orientation, your mindset. And then a lot of students now, a lot of people have spent a lot of time alone, and they sit in front of the computer, as intellectuals do too. And if you did that from childhood, playing video games or watching TV, you don't have the social wherewithal, the skills, and the actually social pleasure hanging out with others. You have to build that too. So we play folk song games, and we play with kindergartners, and we try to build that too. And then we also expand the imagination, which is our what we think about what's possible, who we are, our meaning making, our storytelling, our ways we set up our own personal narratives, and we expand it to include the earth, to include our nature connection in this landscape where we are, our connection to everyone and to everything.
Yeah, and I guess I agree with all of those things. I have, my worldview reflection list of common and dominant worldview manifestations and common indigenous worldview manifestations, and it's way too long of a list to go through. Acceptance of rigid hierarchies under one versus such and such, right? But I use a mnemonic I call the cat and fawn that actually came to me in a vision. In Copper Canyon in Mexico, when I was down there trying to kayak the river. And the vision related to a mountain lion and to a fawn that the Tarahumara Indian was carrying. CAT stands for concentration activated transformation, which in essence shows that ultimately when we want to learn to be more generous or more caring, willful determination is never sufficient. It's good for other things. That's what ceremony is. Ceremony is going in with intention, changing into a brainwave frequency that puts us essentially into a self-hypnotic state, and then having the imagery of being more generous, more caring, more a better hunter, whatever it is. So CAT is on the one side of it. Fawn is on the other. And that is between the two worldviews. Again, this binary I'm using. Fear, authority, words, and nature, F-A-W-N, are so differently assumed under the two cultures, generally speaking. Under the indigenous culture, fear is a catalyst for practicing a virtue, like courage, patience, fortitude, humility, generosity, as opposed to something to avoid at all costs. Authority is only essentially the reflection on personal lived experience under the umbrella of recognizing everything is interconnectedness. The rigid hierarchies are only seen either as reverse dominance or as advisory. The third one is words. Words were understood, but whether it's self-talk or talking to others, as sacred vibrations that required the ultimate opportunities of probable truths and understanding the multifacetedness of truths. And the last one is, of course, N, for nature, that we are part of nature and that nature is a teacher. And I find over the years that when people look at how their behaviors that are not healthy, not optimal, in all the ways that we're talking about, that they recognize that they are entranced into those. And they can go back and change it by looking, well, what is it that, how do I think of fear in this situation? What am I afraid of? Who is the authority for telling me how, that guiding me in the ways that I am acting? What was that authority? What would be the option to that? What words am I using when I refer to the situation? And how have I gone out and in my garden or on top of the New York City building and the plants that I have, or in the woods, or my pet? How have I really looked at the non-human world to learn? And so that's a simple, one simple tool also.
I'm thinking of, as you're talking about that, I'm looking at something from your book, a list of deep nature connection, mentoring, and cultural repair, where it says that we've identified four levels of nature relationship. First is nature information, like anything on books, media, internet. Second is nature experience, outdoor recreation, sports, dog walking, gardening. Three is nature connection. And four is deep nature connection. And I'm thinking about something that Vine Deloria said to me back in the 90s, which is that he would say, you know, a lot of my students will go hiking and they'll come back and say, I had a nature experience. And he would say, well, you had an aesthetic experience. You know, it was pretty. But to really get to know nature takes a long time. And, you know, I've lived where I live now for 20 years. And it is really true that living in this one place and seeing the same, literally seeing the same bears and their children for 20 years is transformative. So can you talk about any of that?
Did you want, Darcy, did you want to say something or?
Oh, why don't you start?
I'll just jump in. I've got, last night I had a bear come up to our window here and we saved some poop for my neighbors for my friends from Idaho that are visiting so they could see it. And, I totally, agree. And I've been transformed by going to the Maggie Creek every year, watching the salmon go up. I cry at their determination and they teach me all the time. Yes, it's true that, and Vine was a friend of mine and wrote his last chapter in my book, Unlearning the Language of Conquest, before he passed. This deep nature connection, though, is impossible for so many people in our concrete jungles, so to speak. And so the starting place is to begin to accept and understand the importance of nature intellectually and then emotionally by doing experiments like, before a conference, I'll have people go up to a tree outside and touch it and come back in. And they'll wonder what the hell that was about. And I'll say, go back out again. Before we start, I want you to touch it again. But this time, I want you to ask permission and really mean it and wait for an answer. And, of course, everybody guffaws and laughs a little bit or shakes their head. But when they come back over the years, whatever age they are, there's always in the reflection and the explaining of what their experience was, there's always somebody that cries. There's always some profound transformation that happens. So as long we've just got to get to the first base here. We've got to start realizing that it's a worldview that has us in trouble and that we raise our children according to the wrong one.
And I can jump in now. What I try to do with my students is expand their sense of relationships. They kind of have a very limited sense of feeling related to their parents and their family members and maybe a few friends. But they don't have this sense yet. I help them, I hope, develop it to the tree that we're sitting under, to the grass they're sitting on, to the spider that walks along nearby, the bird that flies overhead. We're related to all of that. And I think of Jose Mujica, the former president of Uruguay, who spent something like 10 years in solitary confinement. He reported that the way he stayed sane was he shared his food with the mice and the cockroaches each day. And that was his web of relationships right there. And I think we have to find them where we are. And ideally, yes, you're in the same place and you learn the landscape and you know how it changes through the seasons and you see new generations of animals that you know. But if even the little things that we do wherever we are, if we can feel connected to the tree we're walking under in a new city or a bird that comes by, it's amazing how you can suddenly feel like you're part of the whole.
And if I could just jump in to add to that, that it's our education systems. Both Darcy and I are professors. And many of my indigenous brothers and sisters, my fellow sun dancers say, I don't know why you're trying to indigenize the academy. That's where the problems all started. And, you know, they got a point. But on the other hand, it's these systems that continue to reify this wrong headed worldview. And so, you know, we're at a place now where you got this global climate change. How many university professors have come, the presidents have come out to endorse it, right? So we've got a lot of work to do in those systems that train and prepare people as well as these vicarious experiences.
And I'm thinking about how real cultural transformation takes place. And I'm thinking of a couple things. One is that Peggy Reeve Sande did a cross-cultural study of high and low rape cultures. And cultures, a lot of the markers of a high rape culture are ones we would precisely expect. You know, it's highly militarized, it's probably high rape. If men are treated well and women are treated poorly, it's probably high rape. But there was one that always stuck with me, and that's that another one that was very interesting is if there's a male creator deity as opposed to a couple or a female creator deity, that is often a higher rape culture. And the one of the things that really struck with me was the line about how if there is a history of ecological dislocation in the previous few hundred years, and what that suggests to me is that it takes a long time for a culture to really completely metabolize and to remake its relationships. So if somebody says, oh, the shift is happening and we're going to have a global shift of consciousness in 15 minutes on next Thursday, that makes me really nervous. And one more thing about that, which is I asked my friend Jeanette Armstrong, she's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist. I asked her, so how long does it take for someone to become indigenous to a place? For not for someone, but for a people to become indigenous to a place. And, you know, she's just a human being like the rest of us, but she threw out the answer of you know, five or six generations of, because your stories have to begin emerging from the place. So again, I'm just sort of throwing out globs of stuff, and you can take any of this any direction you want.
Well, first, you can't really, you're not even doing it in five generations if you don't know the original language. So, you know, it's that, I mean, that's an extreme answer. But the field of epigenetics shows us that transformations that even reached into the DNA code can happen in a much shorter time. You know, the historical trauma and all of the kinds of things that we're programmed into would take 5, 6, 10 generations and relearning the original languages that speak of nature. And it's, you know, but that's not a possibility for us to act on right now. Now, I don't have hope that we're going to be able to turn things around, frankly. I spoke at the University of British Columbia recently, and I told that to them at the end of my presentation. They asked me, well, why am I here? And I said, well, I'm here to do my best. I'm here to help save whichever creatures that I can so that there will be, and I'm here to help people who are going to rebuild. So they're reading Derek Jensen's books and not Henry Kissinger's, and so, you know, that's the kind of I'm not talking about hope here. I'm talking about what can we do now, and I think it's just as detrimental to say, well, it takes, you know, you have to learn the indigenous language and wait 10 generations as it is to say that we're going to be able to do it overnight. But I do think that there's enough logic in epigenetics to say that if we do what we're all doing on this radio program right now, there's a chance that at least the next go around, even if we're moving into the fifth world, as the Hopis say, that will have made a contribution, because the world is a beautiful place and it deserves it.
I thank you for that. I want to just say one thing in sort of defense of what Jeanette was saying. I think that, I think for me, the understanding that was gained was not that we should, absolutely not just throw up our hands, but that process of transformation is both miraculous and also comprehensible through predictable patterns. It can be a surprise, but at the same time, it takes a while to break out the bad patterns.
Yeah,
that's all. But that can take generations. You know, one generation has violent abuse, and it can take the work of a lifetime for the children of that to try to break that pattern, and then their children can try to break the pattern even more, and their children even more. That's really all I'm getting at.
Well, let me just jump in and say that things can be viruses. Things can change overnight with a meme, a mental virus that goes around the culture. And so I still hold out hope that some way we can have a cooperative virus that infects everyone, and a connection virus. And so I don't think we have to wait for these materialistic kind of, you know, physical. I think that's part of what's going on, of course, is the epigenetics and the material physical effects and how we transform them. But I think there's still hope that we are in many ways spiritual beings as well, and that spirit can really have an infectious positive effect. We see it with the Wetiko virus, the negative effect of the cannibalized life infection that the Europeans brought to the Americas, the New World, so-called, and just wanted to consume everything and grab it. That was quite a terrible virus, which is infecting the whole world now, but we can turn it around, I think, if we see ourselves as more than just a body and a mind, but a spiritual people.
I think you're right, Garcia, because if we can, in a very short time, do the amazing damages and the amazing technologies that we've done, well, what kind of phenomenon has caused that to happen so rapidly? and why couldn't it happen in the opposite direction? You know, when I wrote the Prentice Hall book on emergency hypnosis, I wrote it because the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons said, be careful what you say at the scene of an emergency, because words spoken to a patient in fright can cause untold harm. And I wrote the book saying, well, if it can cause untold harm, why can't it do untold good? And so I agree with you, Dorsha.
So I we have about 10 minutes left, and there's a couple questions. One of them, you sort of answered this four arrows, but can you be more explicit? Both of you be more explicit. What are you trying to accomplish with your work? What do you want listeners of this to understand and to act upon? And then there'll be another question after that.
Well, I'll jump in. I want them to realize this is not, it doesn't have to be this way. That humans are not naturally aggressive and violent and selfish. We are naturally cooperative, but it has to be shaped by experience, and that we have to let go and be vulnerable. We have to let go of our ego and connect. And there are ways to do that. And there's ancient ways to do that, that the indigenous peoples of the world can and teach us. And so it's a wake-up call, essentially. And I try to wake up people who are going to be parents or grandparents to realize that they have a lot of power. Mothering, nurturing really has a lot of power in bringing about people who actually can live on the earth as sustainable members.
I couldn't agree more, and I would just say probably the same thing in different words. I would say that my work efforts are all aimed at helping people realize that courage is a requirement, and courage can be transformed into fearlessness, into trusting the universe once you make a decision to act, and that having a strong social purpose is important for reasons that relate to the beauty that's all around for future generations. And now if we can, you know, use our understanding of worldviews to avoid our compliance to rigid hierarchies and authoritarianism, and gain that understanding of what happens in a fear-based society, understand the power of what, you know, we can refer to as self-hypnosis or trance-based learning, that we can meet our obligations for the beautiful gift that this world has been offered to us.
So there's one of the chapters in the book talks about how in the Cree language there is not a word to describe spirituality. The word they use to describe that connection, I can't pronounce it, it translates to the gifts we were given as a Four Directions people. And the gifts we were given is really important here, I think. And then the next paragraph starts, what is the universe trying to tell us? And then the couple paragraphs down, it ends. This is very, very powerful. What will it take to shock us out of our current perceived reality and assist us to change our perception of sustainability and ultimate survival? So what will it take? Let's go with that last question in the context of everything you've said about, you know, us being born whole, really, and the gifts we've been given. And you just said that, you know, the gift that the of life that the planet gives to us. What will it take to shock us out of our current perceived reality and assist us to change our, to change?
Well, Richard Rohr, who I'm reading, suggests that we need a God experience, a spiritual experience that kind of wakes us out of our false self, our false narratives, that gives us a sense of that oceanic feeling, the connection to the whole, the sense of mystery and very mystical kind of response. And that generally, he says, it doesn't really happen till midlife. You start to realize that all the stuff you learn to do to stay successful are not satisfying anymore, because you suppressed your shadow self, which is actually your sin, in because it keeps you from being connected to the whole. And so I think we need that sacred experience of the sacred in some fashion, and re-sacralize our world.
And just to support Darsha on that, instead of coming up with an additional thing, the Cree Sundance leader, White Standing Buffalo, myself and Bruce Lipton, a guy who writes on epigenetics, every year now for the last 4 years, we have under White Standing Buffalo's tutelage and leadership, offered no charge for people all over the world to experience a 4-day Sundance and to participate in every way except for the actual dancing and piercing. Now, many of my brothers and sisters think that that's not correct. In my own Sundance, non-Indians aren't allowed to come. But we support this because of what Darsha said. We've had now probably 300 people who have experienced this, what Darsha calls a God experience, this sacredness. They've seen what happens with the response of the thunder beings and the clouds and the energies of the living tree of life. And they have all, I've interviewed a lot of them, and they all have had, they've gone back to their communities truly, truly transformed. So, just an example to support Darsha's idea.
So thank you for all of that. And, I'm sort of hemming and hawing because the difference in worldviews is so huge, and I'm trying to, and also your book is so, I mean this in a good sense, is so exhaustive in its explorations of this. It's so full, is a better word. It's so ripe with its explorations of this. I'm trying to figure out how to sum up. What's a question that will sum up this, both your book and this interview? And I am failing completely. So, can you help me on this?
Well, let's ask our respected listeners, who, tune into you for all the right reasons, and I think because they're open for a departure from the status quo, that remember the water that we swim in, that proverbial water that we swim in, that's what's missing. And so look at the mini charts. Darsha has one in one of her books. I've got one in mine. There's others that have, where you can just look and say, well, what kinds of general beliefs are under this dominant worldview relating to competition, anthropocentrism, truthfulness, on and on and on and on. And what are those options that we live for most of human history? And how am I living in one or the other? And what can I do to get into the other more? And I think all the things in our book, all those chapters in our book, those multifaceted chapters, each of them presents sort of parts of that. And so it doesn't really matter where you start in the book, whether you go from the end to the beginning or just hit and miss once in a while. If you're keeping in mind your worldview and what it is that you can do to change, I think that is where the closing potential is for our presentation today.
Yeah, and it's being open to the signals from the universe to open the door and to explore and not be fearful. So lessening your fear of difference, of diversity, and making friends with someone who's different from you. You have to start small sometimes, and then it can be a massive shift all of a sudden. You have to take the first step. So the listener, they need to reach out, open that door, take the hand, and have the courage to move forward.
Just last night I was reading this list of dogs who had done heroic things, or dogs who had survived a fire or whatever. And like several times in this article, it said, if dogs could only talk, what lesson or what stories they would tell of this adventure. And I kept thinking every time, no. It's if you could hear them, what stories you might hear. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with the trees, et cetera.
It's a combination of perspective, adherence and perspective interpretation, and an embracing of the mysterious. And, you know, I think that's part of what diversity is about. It's, you know, and, what our dogs, would say versus what we would hear. I wouldn't call it a versus. I would say it's what our dogs would say, and how we hear it is that partnership that we got to look for.
Yeah, I call it receptive intelligence, something that we have undermined in our schooling, that keeps us tuned in, our attunement, our flexible attunement to all the others, the more than human, that has creates our humanity, actually.
And it creates a humility. When I used to train wild horses, I wasn't in control. They were like major biofeedback machines. And so the biggest lesson wasn't in what they were saying to me about their experience. It was really more about how they were teaching me to interpret my own.
Yeah, beautiful.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for all your work in the world, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Four Arrows and Darsha Narvaez. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.